Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Northern Pass is chosen for a long-term energy contract negotiation with Massachusetts. Lawmakers consider raising the minimum age for marriage, and services provided by Serenity Place of Manchester are divvied up among other organizations in the state that can help people struggling with opioid addiction. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them on the Roundup today. And you can call in with your questions or comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We want to know what you think about these stories, both the ones I mentioned and others that you think are really important. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and NHPR's Annie Ropeek. Everybody, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.
Thanks. Good morning, Peter.
We're going to start the show talking about Northern Pass. And again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And we're going to go first to Annie Ropeek because she's been covering the Northern Pass story in detail. Annie, you reported that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has selected the Northern Pass project for long-term energy contract negotiations. What does that mean exactly?
So Massachusetts was put out a request for proposals to supply 1,200 megawatts of renewable energy to its grid for over a 20-year contract. And they got more than 40 proposals for that, you know, little solar projects on up to these huge transmission lines, including Northern Pass. And they made their announcement yesterday that they picked Northern Pass to cover the whole amount. So it was the only project chosen, and they're now going to enter contract negotiations for that 20-year contract to supply the sum total of the energy they were looking for. So basically, they're buying Northern Pass what it's selling.
Mm-hmm. And presumably because it was the best deal among all those submissions?
Well, yeah. So they say that it, you know, it can provide the most benefit to Massachusetts ratepayers combined with getting online the fastest and basically being the best bang for their buck is what they say. You know, it's a $1.6 billion project is the estimated price tag, but it is the most advanced pretty much of the options that they had as far as permitting. It is just waiting on its New Hampshire siting permit now, and that's expected to come through or not come through in March. And then once they get that, they can move forward. So Massachusetts is, and Northern Pass and Eversource, which is its utility that's backing it, are all banking on that.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if the permit is not approved? What happens to this deal?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. So they say that if something unexpected happens during the site evaluation committee process that's coming up here in the next month, that they'll reevaluate other bids. You know, they do have 40-some other options. So they have other transmission lines that are ready to step in and cover the 1,200 megawatts that aren't quite as close to, you know, shovels in the ground as Northern Pass says it is. But they're just going to wait and see what happens. And Eversource, you know, doesn't really plan to not get that permit. They want to finish construction by the end of 2020, which is when Massachusetts, by its own state law, says this has to be done. And so they need that permit to go forward, and they're hoping they'll get that kind of by any means necessary.
Mm-hmm. And what does this mean for the whole New England grid in terms of diversity of energy sources? Northern Pass would be Canadian hydropower.
That's right. So, yeah, Massachusetts says that it would cover about 17% of its actual energy load once Northern Pass comes online. It would all come, that 17% would all come from Hydro-Quebec, which would be coming down to the New England grid over the Northern Pass transmission line. Right now, hydro is like a really small share of the load, generally speaking. And so Eversource argues that, you know, this represents diversification. They're adding a huge portion of hydro kind of into the fuel mix. And that hydro could take the place of, you know, the spike in oil use that we saw during the cold snap, or it could take the place of natural gas when we're using more natural gas once, you know, nuclear power plants like Pilgrim go offline in the coming years. You know, critics argue that that doesn't really equal diversity, that diversification would have been picking a bunch of smaller projects, including more solar, more wind, more of everything, basically, in smaller increments, so that, you know, if one goes down or has a problem, it doesn't kill the entire system, that you're not basically putting all your eggs in one basket. But the problem is there aren't that many other eggs that are as large as Northern Pass that can kind of fill that role.
A lot of the other choices that Massachusetts had were smaller projects, you think?
Yeah, they did it in 20 megawatt and up increments. So there were, you know, a range of little solar projects, little wind projects, and also some other big, like 600, 1,000 megawatt projects. So they had a bunch of options to kind of put this all together.
I see. What about the process that Massachusetts used to choose Eversource? I mean, you reported that Eversource was part of the group making that decision that eventually chose the Eversource project, Northern Pass. Was that a fair process?
Yeah, that's right. So Massachusetts says it had an independent evaluator come in and oversee this whole selection process that took place over the past 6 months or so. But the utilities that basically provide the power to ratepayers in Massachusetts that would, you know, take whatever Massachusetts is buying and transmit it to customers, to your house, over the poles and wires, all those utilities, Eversource, National Grid, and Unitil, I think NSTAR is in that mix, they all were at the table because, they have a stake in this. And so they got to help decide what project Massachusetts would buy. So Eversource did have a role in picking its own project. Of course, National Grid had proposals in the mix, too. They could have picked their project, and they didn't. And so Massachusetts says, you know, this was a fair and transparent process. But some of the losers, basically, in this process, including National Grid's project, Granite State Power Link, they're calling for it to be, fully transparent. I guess they want basically the details of the negotiation release so that people have more trust.
Jeff Feingold.
Yeah, I was just going to raise that question because they haven't really released what their deliberations were, what their methods really were for coming up with these answers today. And I mean, is that going to be coming in the near future?
Yeah, it's unclear. I've asked the National Grid folks for some details on like what they're actually asking for when they say they want full transparency, and I haven't heard back yet. But there have been some calls for that, and potentially there could be some more records coming out of this. I'm sure that, I mean, we could submit a public records request for that. This came out 12 hours ago, so that'll all be probably coming in the next. And they're still also just entering contract negotiations. It's not a done deal yet. Yeah. And they have this whole other piece of it coming, which is the offshore wind part of the procurement effort that Massachusetts is doing. So in addition to this 1,200 megawatts that they've picked Northern Pass for, they're also looking for proposals for 1,600 megawatts of offshore wind. Eversource and some others have bids in on that one. And that those results will be coming out in April.
You know, I have to say, you know, just being around here for quite a while, it does surprise me that the state of Massachusetts is going with this one, putting all, as you said, all of its eggs in one basket because, you know, this is New Hampshire, and New Hampshire has a history going back many decades of really just putting, just gumming up the works when it comes to large energy projects. Most recently, we had the gas pipelines, but Seabrook is a great example of that. That was supposed to be two nuclear power plants. It took many, 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 many more years than they expected, and much more money to finish than PS Public Service of New Hampshire had thought they would have to do. So to assume that this 2020 construction timeline is right on the money it just seems like they're really cutting it thin. There's little margin for error on this.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some of the many opponents of Northern Pass yesterday. We're saying, you know, even best case scenario, there's months and potentially years of appeals and court decisions that have to come through before they can get their permit. I mean, it's possible that this process could get dragged out for a really long time. And so, you know, even best case scenario for Northern Pass, they have to move really fast to get this thing, huge, 192-mile project done by the end of 2020. And like you say, Jeff, like it's unlikely that they're going to get the best case scenario out of the site evaluation committee. So we'll see how that goes.
And what has Governor Chris Sununu said about this?
He called it a win for everyone. He says, you know, it was the obvious choice. It's the furthest along. And you know, he's been a proponent of Northern Pass for a long time. And he was happy to see Massachusetts select it. You know, it's supposed to have great benefits for New Hampshire, tax benefits and job benefits in the short term. And so there is the economic argument that, you know, we are supplying power to Massachusetts and kind of reaping some benefits from that.
Well, NHPR's Annie Ropeek, thank you very much for, first of all, reporting on this and second of all, coming here to talk about it.
Absolutely, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've got a lot more to talk about in this hour and our conversation is incomplete without listeners like you. I'm going to say the phone number in a few seconds. Give it a call if you want to weigh in on one of the topics we're going to be discussing soon. Among them, the proposal to raise the minimum legal age for marriage in New Hampshire. There is also a proposal to lower the legal drinking age in the state with some conditions, of course. All right, here's that number. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call now. We'll bring you into the conversation when we start talking about those things. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or of course, you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. So let's talk about Serenity Place of Manchester. We knew this was closing. It had some financial difficulties. We learned a little bit more about why it had financial difficulties. Jeff Feingold, what do we learn about Serenity Place and its financial problems?
Well, basically what it was that they were certainly overtaxed and they just didn't have the ability, apparently, somewhere in organizationally to take care of the financial obligations they had and the financial needs they had.
And just to be clear, when you say tax, you don't mean literally
no,
tax.
No. I meant the
like they had a lot to do and not enough resources to do it.
They provided so many services that were required in this, you know, this addiction crisis we're going through. The, you know, transitional services. They were providing respite services, or they were providing the safe station services through Manchester and all that other stuff. And they just did not have the organization to keep up with it, and in a way, it's kind of a they were kind of the canary in the coal mine on this opioid crisis, because it shows how limited the infrastructure is in New Hampshire to have met the need for treatment services in the state. And so they were being Serenity Place, which had been doing a really good job by all the evaluations or, you know, observations, just was providing so many services because no one else was able or was around to do it. So what they've done now is kind of break up those, you know, what Serenity Place had offered, and now other organizations are doing it. But it still just shows that it's a very tenuous infrastructure we have for treatment services.
Tough to find the resources in need, of course, and now they'll be split up. We heard from some folks this week about that splitting up. Maureen Beauregard, head of Families in Transition, that's the group that's been overseeing Serenity Place. She says splitting things up is actually the best option right now.
Rather than one organization holding it all, which is a huge responsibility, the numbers are off the charts. It's really saying this is a community response to a community issue. And at the end of the day, the people that are looking for help are going to get even better help.
Even better help, says Maureen Beauregard. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, one of the concerns, going back several years as the opioid crisis was clearly growing, was there just weren't enough services available to provide for people who needed treatment for addiction. And they basically expanded rapidly as the crisis grew. And there were some issues with payment based on the kinds of providers they used to help with the treatment. And so it just, you know, it's not the first time an organization has expanded rapidly or had to deal with an increasing caseload in which it just was unable to handle it. So as we're now discussing, it's going to be split up among a number of other entities like Granite Pathways, the Farnham Center, Elliott Hospital. So there are other entities that can step in, but it is instructive. It is a bit of a lesson for how you deal with an expanding crisis like this.
Dan Tuohy.
I'll just add that, you know, Safe Station continues on. They soldier on with this epidemic and this public health crisis. As Dean mentioned, Granite Pathways, Farnham Center in Manchester, they're right in the, and these are just two of the organizations out there that are all in this together.
And meanwhile, as Serenity Place unwinds, it still get the building on Manchester Street. What's going to happen to that, Jeff?
I'm not quite sure.
That's the question. I mean, some of these contracts, I mean, the executive council and the governor did provide additional funding in one of the previous meetings. I think it'll still be used because they were retrofitting. And that building, of course, is the former police station in Manchester. And it's right around the corner on the same block as the central fire station, which is a key component in the station.
We should mention that Serenity Place was the, I think it was the exclusive recipient of people coming through the safe station program in Manchester.
Yes.
So it also, I think, did some work with the Hillsborough County Drug Court. But I mean, that was a crucial link between getting the, you know, the sort of the front lines of getting help through the safe stations and then people being directed to these services. And they were the exclusive providers.
Yeah, I have to say that there was another story that came out just the other day about the number of opioid-related deaths in 2017, and they said they were leveling off, which in some could be read sort, kind of like as good news. But what it means is that the situation, maybe it's not getting worse, but it's not getting any better either. So we're still facing this crisis with now, without Serenity Place, with one less one less way to take on this real serious situation. And it's not just in Manchester; it's all over the state, and it's something that really has yet to be fully addressed.
Well, and they had initially predicted, I think, a slight downtick in terms of the total number of deaths, and now I think they're saying it's basically going to be pretty much what it was last year.
Yeah,
I mean, with 17 will be pretty much what it was in 2016.
Yeah, which is better, it's better that 2017 wasn't worse than 2016,
right.
but
it's not a drop that we initially thought we were going to see.
Exactly.
Right? It is all around the state as well. It's not just opiates. You know, Merrimack and Merrimack Police just created two new positions to crack down on meth. You know, they're obviously right there on the turnpike, and they get a lot of people coming through, and it's just a sign that it's bigger than any one community.
Yes. Merrimack, of course, that's another story we covered this week. They're adding police officers, was it, or at least adding some money in the budget?
Two new officers and essentially a drug interdiction unit.
And I believe Nashua is starting a needle exchange program. Is that what
the second needle exchange program in the state? You know, Paige Sutherland for NHPR reported on that. And it's one of those, it's not an established center. It's one that should be more like a mobile exchange.
Yeah.
You call them up, they go to you.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Give us a call if you'd like to comment on the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Jim in Manchester. Jim, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. Just on the closure of Serenity Place and more generally the opiate crisis. You know, we have, you mentioned Merrimack with the two new police officers for the meth crisis. You know, cities are scrambling to deal with this issue. Serenity Place was doing wonderful work, but doing it on a very bare bones budget, with the city contributing a few $1,000s from CIP funds and lots of charities and private individuals. But there's silence pretty much coming from Concord on this. Total inactivity, an inadequate response, no plans, no funding, no serious response to what is now close to 500 deaths per year and thousands and tens of thousands of families affected. So I think it's damning of our political process and our politicians in Concord that they're letting Nashua and Portsmouth, Rochester, Manchester, and other cities to try and handle this in some piecemeal fashion.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. Jeff Feingold.
Jim raises a really good point about this because, you know, while there's been a lot of talk and in some ways hand-wringing about this in Concord, the actions that have been taken have more to do, in some cases, with enforcement, and also they have not yet come up with, as Jim implied, an adequate amount of funding to really provide the kind of treatment services that are required for this, for what we're witnessing all over, as Dan said, all over the state. It's not something that we can just throw a couple bucks at. This is going to take a big investment, and you haven't seen that initiative taken yet.
Yeah, and a lot of the discussion about funding is going on at the congressional level with Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan and others trying to get more federal dollars into the state.
Yeah.
A lot of pieces to the puzzle. Jim, thanks again for your call. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Coming up, we'll be discussing bills at the State House that would raise the minimum age for marriage and lower the minimum age for drinking. Also, the government issues a scathing report on how the Department of Veterans Affairs has investigated whistleblower complaints at the Manchester VA. To weigh in on these topics, call 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and of course, with you. Give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about the proposal to lower the age for raise the age for marriage. It's currently 13 for girls, 14 for boys. It'll be 16 for both of those genders under this new legislation. And speaking on The Exchange earlier this week, Republican Representative Dan Itza of Fremont said that 16 seems like a reasonable proposal.
I'm going to be sure before I vote, but I think it's a very good point to sit at. It is certainly it's the floor for consensual sex. I mean, if we're not going to allow marriage under the age of 18, why are we allowing sexual activity under the age of 18?
So we'll go to you, Dean Spiliotis, for that. What's your take on this issue?
Well, I think, you know, Governor Sununu has said he backs raising the age. I think a lot of people are probably surprised to learn that with parental consent, your daughter can be married at age 13, your son at age 14. There had been a proposal, I think, last year or the year before to raise it to 18. So I think people believe that this is 16 is sort of a reasonable compromise on this in sort of the current context of marriage.
Mm-hmm. And previously, the legislature had narrowly defeated a bill to turn it to 18, right, Dan Tuohy?
Yes, they did. In this debate, it's always interesting that the New Hampshire legislature, they debate so many issues from A to Z. It's amazing. So the bill to raise it to 18, the sponsor of that bill is one of the sponsors of the bill to raise it to 16 for both boys and girls. It's a companion piece of legislation that would provide better or clarify instructions for judges when they have a say in this as well. So there's a couple of different bills that are pending now here in Concord.
So judges would still have a say even at age 16?
Yes.
Yeah. And what do you think of the likelihoods that this one will get through? Anybody?
Having the governor come out like he did was interesting. I think, you know, that he's using the Billy pulpit there for this issue, and we'll see where it goes in the House.
Jeff, you seem to agree?
As opposed to, last time Glasgow around, it didn't really get that kind of attention. There was, discussion, and actually, I think a lot of people were awakened to the reality of the 13 and 14 age limit, and that was. I know personally, to me, I said, "Holy mackerel!" that's just not.
Is the reality that this is happening?
I, as far as I know, it hasn't happened or it doesn't happen. But it's just the idea that that the state has a law that allows it. It just seems not exactly in keeping with a modern progressive state.
Yeah, I mean, is this?
I'm not making light of this.
Right.
But I'm just saying it just seems,
happening. There was a case in Newmarket a couple of years ago. Representative Jackie Seeley mentioned it on The Exchange this week that some very young people were married and that since they've been divorced, she pointed out. And I think it's like 88 people under minors have been married since 2005, I believe it was a stat. And the state does keep track of this, but it's not, how do you describe it as a big issue? Like, well, this 88 teenagers getting married, if they're under 16, it's notable, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this was a law that was created what, 100 years ago, something like that, Dean?
Early 1907 or 1908, something like that, I believe, early 1900s.
Certainly can't speculate about the motives of legislators 100 years ago, but...
Well, lifespans
different
also
time,
were different.
Right.
It was different. And, you know, children weren't exactly even, I don't even know if there was still, if there was universal education in 1907 in New Hampshire. I'm not quite sure about
perhaps
that.
Perhaps a more agrarian society back then, different rules, different ways of living. Interesting to see where legislators may go with this, but the governor has announced support for it, so we'll see. Another bill under consideration having to do with age would lower the legal drinking age to 20, but it's not without certain conditions. Dan Tuohy, what are the conditions under which some lawmakers want to make it legal for people the age of 20 to drink?
Sure. As I believe it was Holly Raymer for the Associated Press reported on this, and it was in the Concord Monitor as well, talking about the conditions being that they'd be lowered to 20, but in private settings. So, you know, the 20-year-old cannot go to a bar, for example, or a public spot and be drinking. And this is one of those... Again, your eyebrows rise up, and you're like, "What is this bill about?" It may be an unlikely success if it passes the House, but we will see.
It just seems like a little bit of a complication to the law, and you know, there was some argument that it may be a way to keep younger people interested in staying in the state. I don't know about the reality of that. There was also another bill out there to raise the smoking age to 21. So you raise one up to 21 and lower the other to 20. These kinds of lifestyle bills often sort of have competing, cultural interpretations of what you should or shouldn't be able to do. But there are often, ramifications for federal funding or in the case of cigarettes, some people have argued that, yes, it may lower teen smoking if you bump it up to 21. On the other hand, you're going to lose the cigarette tax revenue if you do that. So there you hear these kind of competing arguments about both the cigarettes and alcohol.
Yeah, well, Dean, I want to get back to the cigarette question,
sure.
Not since you brought it up, because it's an interesting story. Yeah. But let's also hone in for a moment on the laws tying the drinking age to funding. And maybe, Jeff, you want to weigh in on this, because there's highway funding at stake, right?
Yeah, that's why there's basically a uniform drinking age across the United States, with the federal government many years ago, I think it was in the 80s, basically said if you want to get your highway funding— a certain big chunk of it is tied to making sure that you have a drinking age of 21. And in New Hampshire, I believe that's about $17 million a year, which is nothing to sneeze at. And the sponsor of the bill, Dan Hines, I think he's from Merrimack, he's insists that it's not going to affect the funding because it's just a matter of private drinking as opposed to public drinking, which I didn't quite get that. Does that mean you can't drive a car?
Right.
Or,
you can't buy it, but then someone can bring it home for you to drink at 20.
I
remember, growing up in a state where in high school the drinking age for me was 18, and then I went to college in a state where it was 21. We no longer have that.
Yeah,
kind
there really is a legitimate argument about whether the drinking age should be lower. But to use it to say, first of all, that it's 20 just seems almost kind of, all right, so juniors in college can drink or something like that?
Yeah, you raise a good point. There's been a couple of bills over the years. Jim Splane, the former state rep, had sponsored a couple of bills to lower to 18, citing the fact that we have servicemen and women who are serving our country overseas. They should be able to buy a drink.
Yeah, and that's been the argument for years about this. But this argument of saying you can drink but privately, and you can binge drink in your frat house or something. I mean, that's what it sounds like, and it's not. I don't think it's fully thought out myself. I'm voting on it. So
yeah. Well, for those who are voting on it, you think it's going to go anywhere?
I tend to doubt it, especially in this current atmosphere about with drugs and alcohol and just the addiction going on here. I just can't imagine that's going to get too much play, but you never know.
Well, let's go back to that cigarette story for a moment, because you mentioned it, Dean. And so who is proposing that we raise the smoking age to 21?
Who sponsored. Jeff, do you know who sponsored the bill?
I think it's a senator. I can't remember.
I don't know if it's Andy Sanborn. I'm not sure, but I think I heard him talking about it.
But it's coming from a public health perspective?
I think I heard Sanborn arguing against it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who proposed it, but the idea is that teen smoking is a problem. Kids get addicted to cigarettes. Once they start as teenagers, it's very hard to stop. You bump it up to 21, that'll help. And I think the argument I heard Sanborn make was the alternative about revenue and also kind of the live free or die ethos being under attack.
Yeah, it was a group of teenagers from Dover who were promoting
that's right. There were some students
and they
who
came
were
and testified
right.
in favor of yes. the bill.
This is the weekly.
It was Senator Waters actually.
Senator
from Dover, who is the who's behind the bill.
Gotcha. Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call to join this conversation, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to go back to the subject of marriage for a moment. Talk to Suzanne from Concord. Hey, Suzanne, thank you very much for giving us a call. What's up?
Good morning. This is not only in regard to marriage, but my thought with some experience in education is that real consent, real decision-making has a lot more to do with brain development, sociological issues of pressure in regard to young children in their adolescence than the age. So if I, as a concerned parent or a concerned educator, were to decide the age for marriage or the age for consent, alcohol, smoking, it would really be closer to the age of 25 when the brain is developed, and especially the decision-making parts of the brain.
Well, Suzanne, thank you very much for weighing in. Age-related questions abound here in this part of the show, and she's addressing all of them, it seems. 25, the age where, whether the law says you're ready or not, that's when the brain is done developing. Dean, is this something you've heard?
Actually, just by coincidence, I was having a conversation with my teenager about this very issue, and she was pointing out to me that brain development continues up until, I think, the age of 23. So there is kind of a medical / developmental cognitive reason for putting this off. I've also read research that suggests that the rates of divorce are much higher for people under the age of 25. So there is some kind of, scientific and medical research behind giving kids more time to develop before they have access to a lot of this stuff. But as I think Jeff and others pointed out, there are these trade-offs in terms of, if you're serving in the military or you're treated like an adult in other respects at age 18, shouldn't you have access to these things?
And we get an email from Pam in New London who has a couple of comments. Her first comment is, why are they, presumably lawmakers, wasting their time in this issue of marriage age with only 88 people married since 2005? That seems like a rhetorical question on Pam's part. Also, she says, meanwhile, lowering the drinking age is a problem since these young people do drive. If we didn't control the liquor sales, would this be on the agenda? Seriously, we don't have enough problems without adding more. That is from Pam in New London. Thanks very much, Pam, for writing an email. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about the new report that's critical of how the Department of Veterans Affairs has responded to the Manchester VA whistleblower allegations of substandard care. To join the conversation on that or anything else in the news this week, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or that email address, exchange@nhpr.org. If you're already on social media, you can find us on Facebook, leave a message for us there at NHPR Exchange. So let's shift gears a little bit, talk about full-day kindergarten, because a new law boosting funding for full-day kindergarten in New Hampshire is still taking effect, but some lawmakers are ready to go further and sort of decouple the lottery game Keno from how well kindergarten will be funded. Dean, tell us a little bit about this. What's going on here?
Yeah, I believe this is Senator Dan Feltes from the Concord area, who's been a big proponent of full-day kindergarten for a number of years. Certainly in the last campaign cycle, he talked about it extensively. In terms of whether this is the right time for this, it's hard to say. I think people are still waiting to see the impact of the combination Keno and kindergarten funding, the sort of partial funding of of kindergarten. You know, there's some sort of a related story up in Lebanon. Residents are still trying to get Keno on the town meeting ballot in March because the city decided after a public hearing not to go forward with Keno. So I think people feel this is sort of still in process. So maybe it's a little bit early, but you know, Dan Feltes has been a strong advocate of full day kindergarten, you know, for as long as he's been on the political scene. So my guess is even if it's too soon, he will keep this on one of the burners for the foreseeable future.
Dan?
Yeah, and there is a bill filed in this session that would scrap or try to dismantle the law, and it comes from a state rep from Rochester, which is one of those communities that voted on this last fall. At first, they had a recount and they realized that after the recount, no, the voters did not pass Keno. It's quite a story. And that representative, Matthew Scruton, is very vocal about why the state should not have this. But several communities, as we know, already have Keno. And I think this is going to be one of those things that will really, really take the pulse of the state come town meeting time this spring.
Yeah, yeah. And the initial results from the limited Keno operations is that they've been going better than expected in terms of raising the revenue that they wanted to have. So that's another issue that, you know, the lawmakers will have to weigh in making this decision. But Senator Feltes, as you said, has been doing this for a long time. And there's others as well who say, you know, why are we tying it to this one source when really it should be the state doing it a little bit more holistically?
Right. And that's an argument that's been made from the beginning.
Yes.
That why couple these two?
Yes. Yeah. And that's he's raising this again with this bill.
All right. Let's talk about one more thing before the break, and that is the Office of Child Advocate, because the Executive Council has approved Governor Sununu's nomination of Maura O'Neill as director of this new office that's going to help better protect children. So, Dean, maybe go to you. Sure. Who is Maura O'Neill?
Maura O'Neill is an individual who's has long experience in sort of the issue of child advocacy. She comes, I believe, to us from at least a decade of experience doing something similar in Connecticut. She was approved by the Executive Council on a 3-2 vote. And this child advocate is a position that was created in the wake of, you know, DCYF issues with caseload and some high-profile child deaths as a result of inadequate monitoring. So, you know, people have kind of been waiting to see who was going to be the individual who was going to step into this new position, and she is it.
And Dan?
Yeah, well, this is really quite a turnaround from a year ago when they had that investigation showing the DCYF in crisis. You know, we had on the show this week the new director appointed this past fall, saying there's been 20 additional people hired at the end of last session. So there's a lot of things in works here in terms of looking out for the welfare of our children.
That was badly needed, right? They needed more people, needed more hands on deck to help out at DHS.
Yes. Yeah. In the industry, social work, there's a lot of turnover, of course, dedicated men and women, but it's not unique to New Hampshire. But when this happened on the crisis and the backlogs, some of these social workers that were essentially like we're looking after foster parents, for example, were reassigned essentially to look at after the higher priority cases. So.
Yeah, and there was just – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say that the whole system is really in a crisis is an appropriate word. Just if you consider where the foster system is right now, it's definitely undermanned or whatever. There's not enough people doing it because directly related to the opioid addiction crisis. And I know that the organization CASA, court-appointed special advocates, are stretched very thin in terms of finding people because they have just an overwhelming number of cases of children whose parents are just not capable of taking care of them, and that's DCYF is the that's the big kahuna there that just has not had the resources to address these issues.
Yeah, I was just going to say that there was some reporting back when this all first broke by NHPR and other media outlets actually talking with caseworkers who were in the system, and they just completely overwhelmed, no time to file reports or do paperwork, low pay, not a lot of opportunity to make additional overtime income. And so it's just they needed to sort of, as Dan said, expand the number of people who are involved and also have this child advocate as kind of an outside, essentially advocate for these children.
Yeah.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Dan Tuohy and Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review. And with you, we hope. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. After the break, we're going to be talking about Hampton Beach and the tension between the town and the state. That's a big story. Max Sullivan is going to join us from Seacoast Online to give us a breakdown of what's been happening. We'll also talk about the Manchester VA. We'll be talking about marijuana legalization in Vermont and what it might mean for New Hampshire. And of course, a story many journalists have wanted to be talking about for years. Man bites dog. This is not The Onion, folks. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by Max Sullivan of Seacoast Online. We're going to talk a little bit about the tension between the state and the town of Hampton regarding the beach there and emergency services. Who pays for those? If you're from Hampton, would like to weigh in, give us a call now so that we can bring you into that discussion when it starts. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. How do you feel about the town's relationship with the state and how the state has been taking care of Hampton Beach? 1-800-892-6477. Before we get to that, I want to address this new report from the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, which says that the Department of Veterans Affairs was a bit too slow to respond to accusations by whistleblowers at the Manchester VA about substandard care, and that the VA was a bit too quick to declare that in some cases, appropriate care was provided. The whistleblowers, of course, dispute that claim. Dean, what is your take on this report?
Exactly as you laid out, the Office of Special Counsel issued a report saying that the Manchester VA failed to take seriously the whistleblower complaints and that they just did not respond in an appropriate way. And they have now responded with a kind of a laundry list of the things that they have done since this broke in an effort to show that it was responded to in a timely fashion. But, you know, we've talked on the roundup for some time now about the concern that the VA was really probably not the best entity to kind of self-police and solve these problems. But and this seems to be sort of indicative of that.
Yeah, the self-investigation part of this is still ongoing, and it's unclear exactly when the Office of Medical Inspector will come, you know, full circle with its complete report. But some comments from those involved, including Ed Coyce. He's the leader of the whistleblower crew. He emailed me earlier, and I want to read his statement quickly. He said, the problem was what occurred before VA Secretary David Shulkin got involved. The local VA and the VISN, which is the regional network, knew about these problems for years. The Office of Medical Inspector started investigating in January 2017, and their report, their first report, came out in June 2017. It was a complete whitewash, and Coyce says, if it wasn't for the Boston Globe article, case closed. Democrat Annie Custer released a statement on this report. She said, the VA has proven itself unable to perform a fair internal investigation of the mishandling of veterans care in Manchester. She continues, it's clear that a more independent investigation is necessary to identify what went wrong at the Manchester VA Medical Center. And finally, one of Custer's would-be challengers in the Congressional District 2 race is Republican and VA whistleblower Stuart Levinson, who said of this most recent report, the VA is incapable of performing an honest investigation. When government agencies are allowed to investigate themselves, you get a cover-up rather than honest scrutiny. There was a brief mention of the VA sort of responding to this complaint. Dean, what did they say in response to this report?
Yeah, they basically, you know, my recollection was basically it was a laundry list of the changes they've made in order to show that they are being responsive now to the concerns that have been raised. But, you know, the bigger issue is even if you make changes, There needs to be kind of a larger change in the sort of the culture of how these complaints are treated, and the sort of institutional structures that are set up to deal with this in a way that this won't happen again. And again, it comes back to the question raised by you and Annie Custer and others about the ability of the VA to self-police itself on these matters. And there was concern about that expressed very early on in this whole story.
The troubles of the VA go way beyond Manchester, and that's I think it's the culture of the whole department. It goes back to the days when the Washington Post did a remarkable series of articles on Walter Reed, and then of course we heard about those problems in Arizona at the VA hospital, and it's been all over the country, and it seems as if it's just a. To say that it's a slow moving battleship is not even that's not fair to battleships, and it shows no desire, I guess, culturally to really address these things and really do something proactively about it. It's just in reactionary mode all the time, and this is what happens. You multiply it all over the country, and that's why people are so frustrated.
Difficult situation for sure. I want to make sure we get to some of the other subjects we wanted to talk about today, including Hampton and the beach there. And let's bring in Max Sullivan to the conversation. Max has been covering the dispute between the state and the town of Hampton over how the beach is handled there. Town is looking to file a lawsuit. Max, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Max,
no problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, glad to have you here. So,
you can hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Sorry about that. So Hampton Town Selectmen are arguing that they are providing services to the state park visitors at the town expense. What services are the selectmen talking about?
Well, we're talking about police, fire, public works. See, Hampton Beach is split between the town and the state, because the state owns Ocean Boulevard, and they own the land east of that road. And the other side is the town. And the town is saying, well, you guys make a lot of money off of the parking revenue on your side of the beach, and you collect taxes from our businesses, the hotels, all the tourists we draw. They're saying, if you make that money, you need to pay more, they're saying, to help us with fire, police services. Specifically, they said ambulance services last year. They're saying, we're strapped to take care of all these tourists, and if you're going to make money off of this area, you need to help out a little more, too.
Right, because when someone calls 911 there.
And they're willing to
go to court over it. Yeah, so they're willing to go to court in part over, if there's ambulance costs, the town has to pick that up. And of course, they're concerned about the taxes. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you were going somewhere interesting, because the town knows that when someone calls 911 on the beach, you can't not go. So they understand they have to go, but like, for example, last year they sent a bill for about $44,000 to the state saying, can you help us pay for ambulance services? And they were ignored until they said they'd sue, and then they were told they were rejected. So the state doesn't agree.
Mm-hmm. And how has the governor been handling this?
So the governor came down last week, and he held a public forum. He invited the selectman chair, Jim Waddell, to be on a panel, and he opened the floor and said, basically at the beginning of this meeting at Hampton Beach, he said, I know there's a suit coming. I don't really understand it. Let's talk about it. And then at the end of the meeting, he said, I still don't think that you guys should file the suit. And he also called out one selectman, Phil Bean, for not even being there. And he said, what does it say if the loudest voices, this is not a direct quote, but basically his point was, this is one of the loudest voices in favor of the suit is in here. I question the legitimacy of the suit, he said.
And so, has Phil Bean responded to that?
Yes. But he's also backed by the selectmen. The following selectmen meeting, three of the five selectmen called it a hit job together. They thought that it was a political move, and they believe that that meeting with the governor was ultimately fanning the flames for, their suit.
Is it not unreasonable for a governor to go there, though, and say, hey, maybe you guys shouldn't sue us, from his perspective?
Well, yeah, and there are people who agree with that. And there are people, including one of the selectmen, even, Regina Barnes, who said that she still wants to sue and believes that there was something wrong with the meeting. She agreed that it was optimistic. It was a good thing the governor came down. And there was actually one, there have been people who are saying, listen, you guys forced the state's hand. You said you're going to sue. The governor finally showed up. Don't sue. They're saying, just hold off now. Let's see what really happens. But the selectmen are still saying, we still need to go before a judge.
All right. Let me get clear about what the nature of the suit is, too. I mean, are they suing also about the rooms and meals tax? Because Regina Barnes has also raised concerns about the fact that, they raise a lot in the rooms and meals tax because it's a tourist destination, but not all that money stays in Hampton.
Right. Well, the truth is, no one quite knows what this suit is going to look like because it spans multiple departments, and selectmen won't talk about it because they defer every question to the town attorney, who doesn't answer questions about it. The town set a deadline for next week, January 31st. That's when we're going to be able to see what's in this suit. But no one really knows. No one even knows. I've heard it said, Regina Barnes has said she doesn't understand why people talk about the rooms and meals tax in connection with the suit because she doesn't, she implied, you know, that it might not be involved in it. No one knows what the legal strategy of the town is. They just know that the selectmen want more money to come back to Hampton.
Max Sullivan of Seacoast Online, thank you very much for joining us and bringing us up to speed on this.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Max Sullivan of Seacoast Online. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. If you've got comments or questions about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Ben from Eaton. Ben, I believe that might be Eaton, Massachusetts, yes?
Eaton, New Hampshire.
Eaton, New Hampshire, okay. All right, I see your 508 area code, but go ahead.
That's all right. I was calling because, you know, lately we've had the marijuana House bill and then Keno as well. And I feel as though that those two conversations are not being brought together. Both have serious detriment and both have reasonable prosperity. But, you know, it seems as though Keno's fine and everything that goes wrong with gambling issues, totally fine. Marijuana, no, it's an evil thing. It's a gateway. No good. And I don't understand why they're not being talked about together more. And I'll take my response off the air. Thanks.
Okay, Ben, thank you very much for your call. So the relative perceived evils of gambling and the use of marijuana, not talked about in tandem. Have they ever been talked about in tandem here in New Hampshire? Maybe, Dean?
I don't know that for a fact. I mean, we've certainly had the discussion on each about the potential impacts of addiction. And certainly, Ben mentioned there's the argument you often hear about marijuana being a gateway drug and some law enforcement and medical professionals expressing concern that if you legalize marijuana, as has happened in a number of states right around us, that may in some way kind of further increase the opioid crisis or heroin use, et cetera. So, you know, these kinds of issues about addiction and, you know, individual or, you know, social choice have been around for a long time.
And you know, one of the other arguments of people who are against the expanded gambling as well and that ties it and with the marijuana, or people who actually are for legalization of marijuana are saying, well, look, this is a state that has on its highways, you know, selling liquor. And to say that, you know, someone's can't, you know, have some marijuana that's legal in many, many states, including all states surrounding us, basically, it does seem somewhat hypocritical. And I think that's frustrating to people like Ben and others who support legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a few more stories before the end of this hour. One of them is a bill in the State House this week that could double the maximum security deposit for most New Hampshire renters. Drew support from landlords, but others worried about increasing homelessness. Dan Tuohy, familiar with this bill? What's going on there?
Yes, Casey McDermott covered it for NHPR, and it was, interestingly, one of the most read stories on NHPR.org, and I think it's because it affects so many renters in New Hampshire and the high cost of housing. The bill itself would raise the security deposit from the maximum from 1 month to 2 months. And, you know, some landlords out there say, well, they have costs that sometimes don't get recouped. And housing advocates say, you know, it's going to lead to higher costs and possibly homelessness.
Let's go to Janine from Penacook, who's calling about this. Janine, thank you very much for hanging on. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I am very upset and concerned about this rise in security deposits. For one, we have very expensive rental properties in this area, and housing is extremely limited. I am currently not working. I'm older. I'm looking for work, but I'm living essentially on my Social Security, and I already pay $50 a month extra to have pets. And it's, again, what somebody mentioned about homelessness. That's a big issue for us. Young people, their salaries aren't that great these days. And the demographics of the older population in the state. And one of the things that I found just totally disingenuous was a comment somebody made about
that the landlords would then lower their rents because they were getting more security deposits. And I was, that was just too much for me. It just, one other thing, where I am currently, every year my rent just raised $50 a year, and I'm already paying $600 a year extra per pet.
Well, Janine, thank you very much. So, well, I appreciate your comments, Jean. Thank you very much. And we also had, so count Jean among those who aren't in favor of doing this or who think that it won't lower rent. But there's also Manchester landlord Bill Sturgios, who supports the bill. He says he has maxed out his own credit cards trying to clean up after tenants.
Landlords who are, for the most part, small business people have continued to suffer thousands and thousands of dollars in losses. This bill will help alleviate those losses, and it'll also teach tenants responsibility.
So a couple strong arguments on both sides. Dan Toohey.
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, there were, as you mentioned, landlords that have showed up in force as well. But you see some of the photographs of this public hearing, it was standing room only. And there's people all around us wondering what's next.
So one more story we should talk about before the end of the hour. This is a story I think journalists have been wanting to report for years. I mean, not wanting to, but like, oh my God, if this would happen. Man bites dog. An actual person bit a dog. Dean, do you remember what's going on with this story?
This is an interesting story. You're right. Man bites dog. There was a report of a possible shooting in Boscawen. K-9 unit and other law enforcement authorities responded. They apparently had a suspect they believed cornered in a trailer. So they sent in a canine dog whose name was either Vita or Veda. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. The canine located the suspect. Suspect fought back.
The suspect, by the way, I think was hiding under a pile of laundry, right?
Yes, in a trailer. And they located the suspect. I guess really did not want to be taken into custody, so apparently put the dog in a headlock and bit it back. These dogs are trained to kind of latch on until their handlers can get there, so this sounds like it was quite a struggle. Apparently the dog is okay from a medical perspective, but you don't hear about that too often. Usually the being cornered or latched onto by a canine dog is sufficient, but this individual did not want to be taken into custody.
Even Curly Howard had never been a dog.
Well, the comforting part, of course, in that story was, at the end of the AP story at least, was that the dog had been medically cleared to return to duty. So that was good.
We're
very,
get rabies.
Very, very happy the dog is okay. Well, I want to thank our guests here for being on the show. Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar, School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, NHPR's Dan Toohey. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here the whole hour.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
I want to also thank NHPR's Annie Ropeek for joining us earlier in the hour to talk about Northern Pass. You can find all of her coverage on this issue at nhpr.org. And I also want to thank once more Max Sullivan of Seacoast Online for talking about the dispute between the town of Hampton and the state over how things are handled at Hampton Beach. Remember, the conversation about the week's news continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.